And our special guest tonight, Michelle Belanger, Haunting Experiences. Tonight, we're going to take you into a chilling collection of stories that will take you further than you've ever gone before into the realms of spirits, astral entities, and dark forces. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Michelle Belanger, popular occult author, best known for her writings on vampires. She's appeared on numerous television shows, including A&E's hit Paranormal State, programs on the History Channel, also HBO. Michelle writes for ParanormalInsider.com as well. Her latest work, Haunting Experiences. She's back on Coast to Coast. Michelle, how have you been?
Hey, I've been doing great, George. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine. Man, what a world we're in these days, though. Everything is upside down, but people seem to be embracing the paranormal more now than ever before. At least that's my take. How about you?
I think I agree. I think that every time our culture hits a point where a lot of things are questioned, you know, where we have the economy is in crisis, the world's in crisis, everybody's wondering what else is there. They start worrying about, the spirit world. They worry about what's really going to happen. All of our concerns with the material world, I think, makes us start asking deep questions.
Michelle, give the new listeners a little background into yourself.
Okay. I'm billed as a psychic medium on Paranormal State. It's not a title that I necessarily would have used, even though I do perceive spirits and have done stuff like that. I am somewhat controversial because I identify as a psychic vampire. The psychic is part of that. A lot of people don't always get that. I'm someone who needs to regularly and actively take human vital energy in order to maintain my health and well-being.
I'll be wiped out by the end of this interview, right?
No, it's usually a person-to-person sort of thing, and I keep my hands to myself, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
One of the reasons I started working on Paranormal State is there are a number of people like me. I think it is a type of psychic ability. Some people are psychic, and this is just also a side effect. Kind of think of it as spiritual diabetes. There's just something off with our system, and as kids, we're very psychic. We're aware of the energy of others and the energy in the world around us, and kids being what they are, they do instinctive things to take care of themselves. Most psychic vampires have a chronic health condition, and we're basically self-healing proactively. Everybody's at this point probably familiar with things like Reiki and laying on a hand techniques where you actively put energy into somebody to heal them. So it shouldn't be too much of a stretch to think that some people can learn to take the energy to heal themselves.
As a psychic vampire, do you empty a room when you go into it? I mean, are people exhausted after a while with you?
Well, those are only the people who don't really know what they're doing. Negative psychic vampires, people who don't understand what it is that they're doing, take from people against their consent. And yeah, it's unpleasant to have that taken against your consent. People like me, and there's a whole community of us who realize what's going on and learn that there is just this give and take that is sort of a natural part of the world. And if you are working with someone who has a surplus of energy and you make it a consensual sharing, nobody loses out. It's actually positive. I have a lot of people actually challenge me and like, you can't be a psychic vampire. You've got such great energy. If I know what I'm doing and I know how to take care of it, yes. The side effect is I really know what to do with my energy.
Have you ever, though, used these abilities in the past with the people that weren't willing to share it with you?
When I was growing up and getting a handle on it, I will admit that I was not the most ethical person, partly because I didn't really believe that this was real. I would still act on it, and it was through those experiences, seeing that it had a significant impact on the people that I was working with, that I kind of wised up and was like, okay, this is something I shouldn't fool around with. This is something I need to get a handle on and be responsible about.
What do you think it is that forces you to have this need? Is it something that your body is perhaps not producing the kind of energy, maybe electromagnetic energy that you need, or your consciousness is not grabbing it? What do you think you might be lacking because you are this way, you are lacking anything?
I've got a Chinese friend who's a Qigong master, and I was asking him if his culture had a term for psychic vampires are people like me. And he sort of laughed at me. He's like, well, we don't give it the silly word like vampire. They recognize that there's chi, this vital life force that everybody has. And they recognize that some people have too much chi and some people don't have enough chi. They have a clear list of symptoms that people experience if they don't have enough chi. And those are the symptoms that I go through when my system kind of runs down. And from his perspective, it's simply a matter of balance. So it's ordinary in his culture for people to just share chi and have people like me get kind of like helped along by the people who have more than enough. I do think that physical health is a factor. I was born with a heart defect, and that although I've had surgeries to correct most of it, I have tachycardia and arrhythmia. And those will act up if I don't take energy. And if I do, I have no ill side effects whatsoever.
Good. How long can you go before you need this energy?
Ideally, every 2 weeks. And really, I can go as long as a month. The older I get, the more of a handle I get on it, the more I really learn how it works and kind of, I think of it as my checking account. You know, you don't want to draft a check and overdraft your account.
Sure.
Everything that I do psychically does kind of take an expenditure of energy. And I think anybody in the listening audience who's psychic knows that there's energy you put in when you're doing that work. And, you know, if you're in a particularly like a negative environment or if you're really doing a lot of work to perceive spirits or something, you can end up feeling drained. So my system just doesn't naturally replenish that when I expend it. I have to actively take it.
You're pretty prolific. Psychic dreamwalking, the psychic vampire codex, vampires in their own words, walking the twilight path, and this latest work, Haunting Experiences. So tell me a little bit about this ability you have also to perceive spirits.
For the longest time, it's going to be really funny. I'm okay calling myself a psychic vampire, but it was really hard to publicly admit that I could talk to dead people. I realized how strange that sounds. When I set out to write Haunting Experiences, originally I just wanted to tell some really good ghost stories. The twist, of course, would be they'd all be true. But I've done a lot of nonfiction work, and a lot of it is more teaching sort of work. And I wanted to really kind of stretch my wings with a narrative voice and tell good, gripping stories. Along the way, in recounting my own experiences, I realized that I had really been sitting on the fence, back and forth, experiencing, perceiving spirits, being a part of that interaction with the other side, and yet being very hesitant to be open to others and admit that I could perceive this, always questioning it. It's easy to test the psychic vampirism, to take energy from somebody you can, if you want to set up an experience, an experiment, you can kind of do a double blind where you don't tell them that you're doing it, and they've still acknowledged that this might happen, and they can acknowledge when it's happening, you know, without, you can get feedback from a living person that it is something real that they're experiencing. If my dead friend Bob talks inside my head, I can only ask him to do the same thing to verify it, and I've got no way to absolutely test it. So it was really hard for me to commit to belief that it was absolutely not just something in my head.
Do you think being a psychic vampire gave you this added ability to perceive the spirits?
Almost all of the psychic vampires I know are also perceptive of spirits and are psychic to an extent where they pick up residual energies, the stuff that they call residual hauntings. So I think that it is part and parcel. It's interesting to me that we collectively, a lot of the psychic vampires I know, share qualities in common with what ancient people would call a shaman. Shaman were also like the wounded healer. They had a significant health issue. They learned how to manage that health issue. They had, you know, these visionary experiences. They had a very keyed up awareness of vital energy and an ability to move it from person to person. And ultimately, when they got a handle on it, they became kind of mediators between this world and the next world, and healers as well, potent healers with energy. So I think we've kind of married ourselves to a pop culture image that comes maybe with more baggage and misunderstanding than it really needs. But we don't have a better word for people who take vital energy than vampire right now. But I swear, for all the Twilight fans, I do not sparkle in the sun.
Or run from garlic or anything
no,
like that.
No, no garlic, no coffins, no capes. You can see me wear a pair of vampire fangs in a music video I did with a metal band a long time ago, but that's about
Is that on YouTube?
Yeah, that's up on YouTube. It's called Shadow Dancer. If you do a YouTube search for All Shadow
right.
Dancer and
I gotta see that.
My name, yeah, it's we had fun. It's a satire of the whole vampire image. We just went totally over the top with it.
Have you gotten to a point sometimes if you're, let's say you're at a party. And if you're in need of this energy for some reason, and generally you're with people who share it, but what if there's someone there who is just belligerent to people, mean, just not a good person? Will you, in your own little way, grab the energy from that person?
I try really hard not to infringe on people's persons, even if I cannot stand them.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, flying in an airplane with, you know, that one fussy baby, it's really tempting to take just enough so it goes to sleep. But
from a baby?
Well, exactly. And that's why I don't do stuff like that. Because, I mean, everybody has rights to their own person. And if you really believe that this is something that is true and is happening, that energy is vital to a person. It's part of their essence. It's not, you know, a wholesale part of their soul. It's something that's replenishable. Think of it like their spiritual blood, but it's still personal to them. So you don't take that without their permission. To do so is pretty invasive and, you know, rightly has negative repercussions from people who recognize it and can fight back.
I'm going to be talking with you tonight about just three of your works, by the way, The Haunting Experiences and The Vampires in Their Own Words, and then this Walking the Twilight Path. Who came up with this cover of this skeleton in a top coat and a hat?
I don't have any say on the covers, and I'm not sure exactly what photographer took it. We subtitled it The Gothic Book of the Dead. I have a lot of folks in the Gothic community who follow my work. I think it's got a little bit to do with the whole vampire shtick. Walking the Twilight Path has a lot more to do with shamanism and death and our cultural attitudes on death. Originally, I'd subtitled it a postmodern book of the dead. It's got a lot of stuff from Tibetan Buddhism in there. I'm a huge fan of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Yeah, I can't speak, apparently. Huge fan of the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
I read that, and the Egyptian Book of the Dead as well.
Yes, and there's a lot of parallels, despite the fact they're from completely different countries, vastly different time periods, because they're both books that teach you how to navigate the other side and have an interesting insight into what experience a soul goes through once it has detached from the body and goes through this sort of visionary experience in facing, you know, its what it did in this lifetime in facing down demons and dark beings that challenge it and make it really look at its own actions during life.
You're still in the Midwest, right?
Yep, I live in Ohio.
Is there a huge psychic vampire community out there in the Midwest?
Bigger than you'd think. And at this point, we've actually done enough outreach to a number of other people. We work with a lot of energy workers. Because of the work with Paranormal State, I've been doing a lot of work with paranormal investigators as well. I've had a great time with that. One of my main motivations to start working with the Paranormal State people was to have access to things like a FLIR camera and the various and sundry tools of parapsychology to be able to test my interaction with energy. Josh Light, one of the tech people on Paranormal State, has been specifically designing equipment to test my interaction with energy. A lot of psychic vampires report an inexplicable drain on batteries, like with cell phones and digital cameras.
Hmm.
He's coming up with something that can measure that and prove that there is something going on. I don't seem to get any nutritional value from those batteries, but I will say that the guy who mans my mic pack on the show has said that he would go before a court of law to state that, yes, I go through at least twice as many batteries on any given episode as any other member. And there's equipment failure around me. So there's something about my energy field that has some sort of an effect. I did an episode of Monster Quest where we worked with a tri-field electromagnetic sensor, and when they tuned it to the geomagnetic frequency, it responded to my intentional work with energy. I could make the needle bounce intentionally. Now, that needs more research under more controlled circumstances, but it was certainly compelling.
See, I think Michelle, that people who, let's say they're in a relationship and they really click, I think they give off energy to each other in one form or fashion. They're psychic vampires, aren't they?
Well, everybody interacts with energy and everybody gives and takes it. The only thing that really separates a psychic vampire from your average person is the how much they need to take in versus how much they put out. And really, it's because they tend to be limited to just the energy of people. In Taoism, for example, people are taught to take energy from the earth beneath their feet, from trees, from mountains, from natural sources. And it's very much a part of how you interact with the world, to take energy in and to put it back out. Again, the word vampire ends up being what we get stuck with because we don't have a better word in the English language for someone who seems specifically to take energy from other people.
You have dabbled in near-death experiences. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, it wasn't dabbling so much. I was that heart defect I told you about that I was born with. I went into cardiac arrest at 6 months. It was undiagnosed initially. And I remember one specific near-death experience. I was double-checking it with my mom. And I was like, hey, Mom, you know, did I happen to, you know, die at any point during those surgeries when I was little, you know, that you know of? And her response was, which time, honey? And I thought she meant which surgery, and I'm like, so, because there were two open heart surgeries and all of that and a couple of others. And she's like, no, which time that you died are you remembering? And I'm like, oh, that's comforting.
Yeah.
The one that I remember seems to have been with the final surgery when I was 4 and a half. And it was fairly classic, about 10 feet above and, you know, viewing the whole operating theater.
The whole thing, sure.
Yeah, seeing people working on and being completely detached from my body. There was no sense of pain or fear. I didn't have a sense of concern about the little body underneath all the sheets and people and everything that I could see. Honestly, the thing that sticks out the most in the memory is I became absolutely fascinated with a light fixture. Like, stared at it for a while because it had these really bright lights and this chrome. And I remember staring at that for a while, and then my attention was drawn to another light that was not a physical light fixture. And, you know, being 4 and a half, I had no context for anything that was really being perceived, but just that sense of a light and that sense of everything being right. And
I wonder if that near-death experience, though, kind of jump-started you into this entire ability.
My mother very much believed so. I think that it was a factor. I really think that people who go through that end up kind of with one foot on the other side and one foot here. You can't go through it and not have something change you. I mean, first of all, you no longer fear death. You realize that it's absolutely not the end. There is a lot more to the world and to us than we often give ourselves credit for. It is one of the things that drove me to write Walking the Twilight Path was the fact that many other cultures have this idea of death and rebirth as an initiatory experience, as something that opens a gate inside of us and that we can come back from with greater psychic awareness and with greater awareness of how to interact with life as well. In dying, we learn a lot about life. I had a lot of experience with that with my mother. She was diagnosed with breast cancer shortly before her 40th birthday, and she had the radical mastectomy on her 40th birthday. And she struggled with cancer for 13 years, and in her process of dying, she gave herself permission to live. She was an artist and a violinist. She sculpted, she painted, and she had never had the guts, really, to get into galleries and showings and things. And in those final 13 years, that's when she got involved in community theater, and she did performances, and she got into galleries, and she felt she didn't have anything to lose, so she wasn't worried about losing. She just lived.
She lived and did what she should have done and loved
all
her life.
Yeah, and it was an amazing thing to watch. And I worked with her through the absolute end process. I had already been studying the Tibetan Book of the Dead at the time, and while she wasn't so sure about the whole Buddhist thing, she was Christian, she did like the idea of someone who would talk to her through the process as she was actually dying. And we had a final phone conversation.
Well, she sounds like a remarkable woman, Michelle. We'll be back with more, and we'll get into haunting experiences. Michelle Belanger, we're going to be talking about her most recent work, Haunting Experiences, Encounters with the Otherworldly, in just a moment. The first chapter in Haunting Experiences, Michelle, depicting you playing with a homemade Ouija board. Not a good thing to do, or is it?
Oh, I don't generally recommend that everybody go off and do this, but I've got to say that practically anybody who was a teenager, and I swear teenage girls, especially at slumber parties, end up playing around with them. It's not something that should be used as a toy. My own experience led to talking with a spirit that then decided that it wanted to stay and play. Fortunately, it was a mostly harmless one. One of the things about opening doors to the spirit world is you get what you're asking for, and most of the people who will play with Ouija boards as toys are looking for a cheap thrill. They're looking for something that'll come and scare them, and that's exactly what they're going to get. They're putting out something. They're already asking for something negative to come through. They want some of the spookier slumber parties. They really want something that will come and scare the heck out of them, and then they don't know how to make it go away. There's a very old saying, do not call up that which you can't put down. And a lot of people who will play with Ouija boards casually don't understand that if you open that door, you also need to know how to close it. You also need to know how to protect yourself and to keep entities from invading your space, your energy, and your home. And that's something that they don't tell you on the back of the box.
No, they don't do that at all. And I was going to conduct about a year and a half ago a Ouija board experiment, and I decided not to. I happen to think it's a piece of cardboard, but, you know, I'm sitting back thinking of millions of listeners, some of whom were ready to play with this thing, and who knows what kind of portal we would have opened up that way, Michelle.
Well, the board itself, yeah, I believe it. It's, the board itself is just a piece of cardboard. It's what people are doing with it. It's everything comes down on that level. It's your intention. If you focus your will to accomplish something, and you can think of it as faith as well, the spirit world will respond, and the Ouija board acts as a focus. There are a lot of different ways that you can, a lot of different focuses out there that you can use, but this particular one, because it's been popularized as a game, I think a lot of people think, A, that it's harmless, and B, that it's really fun to make it very spooky, and the more you have that mindset, the more likely you are to invite something into your space that is just as spooky as you were hoping for, and you'll probably regret it afterwards.
Michelle, how do you close the portal? How do you do that once you open it?
Intent and focus. It's really deceptively easy. As long as you can put your fear aside and put your doubt aside and have faith that you can accomplish this, you do the exact same thing just in reverse that you did to open it. If you specifically used a Ouija board to open the portal, go back to hopefully the same Ouija board or the same mindset you had when working with the board. I recommend using the same tool. So if you burned that board, get another one just to sit down and concentrate on, I am closing this portal. I do not invite you into my space. Concentrate on bricking it up. I mean, literally picture that in your mind that, you know, you've got a door open and you are putting it brick by brick, sealing it. And be very firm about those boundaries and that these things are not allowed to come into your space.
It's this intent that has a lot to do with opening and closing then these portals, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Inviting anything from the other side, it has a lot to do with intent. And closing it, again, it's intent, but it's also your faith in your ability to do it. And for people who are nervous about their own strength, I always recommend that if they believe in a higher power, higher powers exist for you to ask for help. So if you really feel threatened by something and you do not feel that you yourself have the wherewithal to keep it out of your life, then rely on your faith in your higher power and ask that higher power to keep this out of your life for you, to watch after you, to, you know, surround you with white light or however you want to picture it. How you picture it, the symbols matter a lot less than the intent.
I was watching cable a couple nights ago, flipping through the channels, and I came across a movie. The guy starring in it was, he played the role of Dr. Giggles, that crazy dentist.
Oh, God.
And I can't remember his name, but anyways, he was trying to summon up the devil. He was evil in this film, and he drew this coven circle, and he was right in the middle of it. and he's chanting all these things. And sure enough, he opened up the door. And what happened was, you know, he thought he was going to be the devil's agent or something. And he got burned alive. And he's there in the middle of this circle, screaming, hollering, burning to death. And it just dawned on me then that once you open up this portal, even though you may think, hey, I'm playing this game, I'm going to let evil in, it's going to be my friend. That's not the case, is it?
No. If you are really trying to bring in something that is evil and you're aiming for like the biggest, nastiest demon you can possibly call up, do not presume that as a mere human you can control it. Most people do not have the background or even the strength of will to order these things around. We forget. I think that we have a popularized image of spirits in general, human ghosts or all of them, that they're sort of like cardboard cutouts, that they don't have personality and that they don't have will of their own. Human spirits, if they are intelligent hauntings, you should treat them and approach them like real people. You can ask them to do things, but there's nothing that allows you to utterly force them to do stuff. It comes down to a matter of will. It would be like having a conversation with a person. So you have something that's in somebody's house, and you ask it to leave. It comes down to a battle of will. Do you have the ability to shout it down and make it go away?
When you act as a psychic vampire to someone who's willing, I mean, what do? Do you bite their neck? Do you touch them? What happens? How do you, or just stand next to them?
I prefer some physical contact because it makes it more real and personable. It's usually like just hands on their shoulders or hands over their hands. And it's just something that allows me to focus. Again, it's that focus and intent on their energy. Breath guides the energy. And, you know, in the Hindu tradition, pranayama, there's a number of different techniques that you use breath and energy and vitality. And it's really the same thing. It's very much like Reiki in reverse. You put your hands on somebody for Reiki to put the good energy in, and a psychic vampire can touch someone and willingly pull the energy out.
Have you ever had anybody take energy away from you?
Oh, yeah. I've had a couple of people attempt attacks like that. And again, it comes down to whose will is bigger. If you recognize it and you can make those boundaries and be very firm in those boundaries and not give in to fear. Fear is one of those things that really opens us up to attack on a lot of different levels, not just from psychic vampires, but from spirits, because you're almost giving it permission by being afraid of it. You let your guard down because you almost assume in the fear that you are going to be attacked and that you are going to lose. So you should be courageous and be firm that you are not a victim.
All right, I understand you have a ghost in a box.
I have a ghost in a box.
Heck is that?
I get some really weird gifts from people. It is the strangest stuff that you'll start getting in the mail from people who find out that, or given in person from people who find out that you can perceive spirits. It's usually the, I have this object, I think it's haunted, what do you think? Or, I have this object, there is this really creepy thing attached to it, could you please take care of it for me? And that's sort of what happened with this. It is the cremated remains of a woman who allegedly killed her family. Her name is Jean.
Jean?
And I had somebody contact me on LiveJournal, of all things, going, hey, I have this thing. I'd like to send it to you. And I'll be perfectly honest. I didn't believe that he had the cremated remains of a spree killer, nor that he claimed to have been able to bind her spirit into these remains and that she was still pretty freaking crazy, even though she was dead. And so, you know, my skepticism was a mile wide with this. And I was like, okay, well, I give my P.O. box. And sure enough, a couple of weeks later, I get a package in the mail. And I'm driving home with the package on the seat of the car. First of all, I was baffled that you can indeed, in fact, mail human cremated remains through the postal system. That is okay. And I stop at the stoplight, and I stop a little bit too quickly, partly because I'm just kind of baffled. Again, I've got cremated remains sitting in a box that went through the postal system, and the box tumbles off of the passenger side and onto the floor. And I kind of, you know, say out loud jokingly, I'm sorry, Jane. And in my head, in that way that you perceive spirits, it's, for me at least, it's like an ear that's somewhere inside my head. It's not with a physical ear. There's just a sudden sense of Jean, like she's scolding voice of correcting the name. And I'm like, okay. Pick the box up, put it back on the seat. Next stoplight, have about the same thing happened, and I got the name wrong again, and I get corrected, Jean. So me being me, I decide to test that there is or is not a ghost in this box. And this is where it gets a little cruel. I have a friend who, fortunately, she forgave me. She's another medium. I'd like to test abilities and perceptions, and I actually have a number of other mediums who I work with and that I trust who I use to get second, third, and fourth opinions. Jackie Williams is an artist that I work with. There's Heather Hoffman out in Phoenix. And when there's something weird, if I have the opportunity, I write down my perceptions, and then I sort of throw them at it. So I had my friend Sarah Vallad come over, and I'm like, hey, Sarah, catch. And I tossed her the box, which doesn't look very much like cremated remains. There's this box that the can is in, and she catches it and immediately goes, what the heck do you have in there? Drops it and just starts a conversation with Jean, who is, I mean, she's cranky. I've used her for people who think that they can perceive spirits and just had a number of things under larger boxes and let the people who were testing their abilities to perceive, you know, see what they could sense with whatever item was supposed to be under these boxes. So it was a blind test. And she's been a really useful teaching tool. She's bound in her box. She doesn't move out of it. I don't quite understand how he managed it. There are some people who believe that, you know, certain magical rituals and certain things will bind spirits. I will admit to having been deeply skeptical about how effective that might be, but she is there. She's in her box, and she doesn't seem to be able to do any harm to anybody except for kind of bitch at them.
So you're not concerned about going to sleep one day having that thing pop up at you?
No. I keep her up on a bookshelf in my library, and she's not caused a problem. I've told her, hands down, she needs to not try to scare my cats, because when I first had her in, my one cat was pretty acted very odd around the box. And she is mostly...
Well, tell her you're going to use her in a litter box if she keeps
up. I've literally, yeah, we have made threats to her. I mean, it's I suppose, kind of cruel, because this is somebody who was a real person, but she is no better in death than she was in life. I have to agree with my friend Wraith, who sent her to me, that she's pretty crazy. I didn't know that crazy could carry over, but she's pretty crazy.
Be careful.
Oh, yeah. I would not recommend casually to anybody else to collect things like this. I've been working with spirits for a very long time, and I will say that with the work that I do with energy and have had to learn how to do, I mean, as a psychic vampire, I've had to learn how to shield myself, mainly to keep my own energy in, so I'm not casually taking from people around me. But the side effect is I know very well how to protect myself, and I teach psychic self-defense to people. But it's not something that, you know, most people just sort of like kind of casually know. But it does
When people say, Michelle, things like, you know, concentrate, create light around you, does that work to shield you?
If your intent is strong, if you believe that it works, it is my belief that what it comes down to is faith, our faith in ourselves or our faith in a higher power to sort of superpower our will. Actually, I've got a book coming out called The Ghost Hunter's Survival Guide. That my work with Paranormal State, I learned that most people did not know how to protect themselves. And even in hauntings that weren't threatening, they got really frightened because they didn't know the rules. They didn't know what would work and what wouldn't work. And in writing the book to as wide an audience as possible, it really does come down to have faith that you can erect these boundaries. You use any symbol that works for you. I've got a friend who imagines a great big fuzzy wool sock that she rolls up from her feet and ties off at the top of her head. And that, you know, big comfy sock, she's got a pair of comfy socks that's kind of the symbol that she uses, makes her feel comfortable, but also gives her a wrapping of protection so that she's very sensitive, she's very psychic. And if she imagines this wool surrounding her, the impressions have some space to go through. They get muffled. so she's not overwhelmed all the time. And if you imagine a bubble, if you imagine a light, if you imagine bricking yourself up behind a wall, the stronger and more powerful the image, the more meaningful the symbol is to you, the more it translates to that part of your mind that actually knows how to do this stuff.
Tell me about this experience you had at Ground Zero.
I happened to end up in New York in February after the attacks at 9/11. And I had honestly expected to go to Ground Zero and find it rife with spirits. I expected to see a lot of hauntings because you think about classic things like the battlefield at Gettysburg.
Yes, huge.
Tremendous event. And just the intensity of the emotion and all of the activity that happened in a short span of time literally seems to have burned those events onto that field. I expected to find the same thing at Ground Zero. And what really surprised me, and this goes along with people's faith and intent, there is a little church that is very close to Ground Zero. When you walk up to it, it's kind of like a little postage stamp lot. Clearly, it existed long before all the skyscrapers, and it has a little cemetery, and the whole thing is surrounded by a tall iron fence. I don't even know the denomination of the church, but everybody instinctively started leaving things on the fence around this church. Prayers, posters, there were strings and strings of origami cranes, you know, thousands and thousands of cranes. Each crane is supposed to be a prayer. And people had left crosses, pictures of the Virgin Mary. You could see all faiths and all backgrounds, and everybody was essentially a massive memorial that everyone had left in this space. And that memorial itself, with all of the intent everybody had put there, there were no ghosts. There was just calm, a sense of quiet mourning, but also a sense of hope. And the collective energy of that hope that we would rebuild, that we could survive, that we would never forget, but that we would move on, that colored the space in ways that I had not expected. I had expected to find absolute tragedy, and instead I found stillness and perfect calm in the heart of New York City. It was really amazing.
That truly is. That's an inspiring story, too. It really is. So these experiences that you've gone through, and we'll get into a lot of them next hour as well, is there one that just scared the living daylights out of you?
There is actually a series of experiences at a specific location in Ohio. I call it Whitethorn Woods because it's a private property. And I have to say, you know, perceiving spirits, not so scary, because there's always that level of plausible deniability. If I perceive something, either think I'm seeing it or if I think I'm hearing it, I can still probably go, nah, could still be my imagination. So it never scares me too much. When objects move, honestly, I've got video evidence that mostly I giggle. I had something on one of the Paranormal State episodes. I thought it opened a door, and I closed the door, and I asked it to open the door again, and it did. And I just kind of jumped up and down like a kid at Christmas. So that stuff doesn't scare me. But when animals start to respond to the weird stuff in an area, that gives me pause, because there's no rightful reason that they should be responding to it. You know, they can't over-intellectualize. They can't be so drawn in by belief that they are imagining things. They're responding to instinct. And when their instincts tell them that there's something really weird going on, I sit up and pay attention. At this property, a whole number of things occurred, but at the end, it had this total Alfred Hitchcock moment.
All right, let's pick it up there when we come back. Michelle Bélanger, our special guest. Haunting experiences, more to come on Coast to Coast AM.